Coming up, the future of artificial intelligence. A famous inventor predicts that we will eventually become hybrids of man and technology.
These computers will match us in emotional intelligence, which includes our whole moral system.
And her husband needs a kidney, but hers is not compatible. If she donates her kidney to a stranger, her husband will get one in return from another stranger.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Tim O'Brien, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thanks for joining us. A new poll this week by the Pew Research Center reports that a growing number of Americans believe, incorrectly, that President Obama is a Muslim. That figure has increased over the past year from 11% of the population to 18%, with most of them saying they got that information from the media. Meanwhile, the number of people who say they know he is Christian has fallen to only 34%. The largest percentage of those polled, 43%, say they didn't know the president's religion, a number which has also risen from last year. Researchers say these changes can be traced to attacks by opponents and to the fact that Obama is not as visibly religious as his predecessors. The White House responded, saying the president is a Christian and he prays every day. As controversy continues to surround plans for an Islamic community center in Lower Manhattan, several prominent Republicans have condemned President Obama's recent comments at a White House Ramadan event. The president said that Muslims have a right to build the Islamic Center, although he later refused to say whether he actually supports the center being built near Ground Zero. At a news conference this week, several prominent Muslim advocates joined Christian and Jewish representatives to express their support for the project moving forward and to condemn what they called the politics surrounding the issue. Meanwhile, New York City's top Roman Catholic leader, Archbishop Timothy Dolan, has offered to meet with the project's supporters and opponents to help work out a compromise. A Muslim woman has filed a discrimination complaint against the Walt Disney Company after her employers at Disneyland told her she'd have to remove the headscarf she wears for religious reasons or take a job out of public view. When Iman Boudlal, a cafe hostess at Disney's Grand Californian Hotel and Spa, refused, she was sent home without pay. Disney says other cafe employees must wear uniforms and that Boudlal's scarf didn't fit in. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission will review the case. A cross you occasionally see on the side of the road may mean different things to different people. The Utah Highway Patrol Association, a private group, planted 12-foot-high white crosses along public highways in the state. The association said the crosses were to commemorate fallen colleagues who died nearby in the line of duty. They said a cross conveys a message of death, remembrance, honor, gratitude, sacrifice. But a federal appeals court in Denver ruled Wednesday the cross also conveys an impermissible endorsement of Christianity by the state. The crosses must go. An appeal to the Supreme Court seems likely. Supporters of California's ban on gay marriage are applauding this week's decision to suspend gay marriages in that state. A federal judge had ruled that gay marriages could begin again, but a three-judge appeals court stayed that decision until further review. The appeals court will take up the case December 6th. Meanwhile, several conservative religious leaders gathered in front of the U.S. Capitol this week to express their support for traditional marriage. The U.S. says it will increase aid to Pakistan to more than $150 million as massive flooding continues to devastate that country. The number of those affected by the disaster has risen to an estimated 20 million, with many receiving little to no immediate assistance. Religious leaders, including the Dalai Lama and Pope Benedict, have offered prayers for the victims. And at his weekly audience, the Pope urged the international community to offer concrete support to Pakistan. Modern technology has taken us to places we could barely imagine only a few years ago. Ever wonder where it might be taking us in the years ahead? We may enjoy new powers over life and death that today may also be hard to comprehend. Life without pain? What about life without end? Advances in biotechnology are all but certain to raise some thorny bioethics issues, too. Lucky Severson reports.
Ray Kurzweil may not be a household name, but the blind know who he is. He invented the first reading machine and then reduced its size to a handheld gadget. Kurzweil will be remembered more as a man on a mission to tell the world what life will be like in the age of technology. Microsoft billionaire Bill Gates said he is the best in the world at predicting the future. And what a world he predicts.
This is a design of a robotic red blood cell.
We're going to put these technologies inside us, blood cell-sized devices that will augment our immune system, make us a lot healthier, destroy disease, dramatically push back human longevity, go inside our brains and actually enable us to remember things better, solve problems more effectively.
We are going to become a hybrid of machine and our biological heritage. In my mind, we're not going to be transcending our humanity, we're going to be transcending our biology.
Kurzweil has written several books. One of the most recent, called The Singularity Is Near, predicts that by the year 2050, non-biological, artificial intelligence will surpass human intelligence, creating a hybrid of man and technology.
What I am predicting is that we will have machines. We're going to need a different word because these are not like the machines you're used to. These are going to be machines that will seem as human, as real, as conscious as any actual human being.
Even if non-biological or artificial intelligence created in places like MIT is not as close to singularity or matching human intelligence as Kurzweil believes, it's close enough that scientists and ethicists are now saying we need to take a serious look at its ramifications. Professor Christian Brueger is a bioethicist at St. John Vianney Theological Seminary in Denver. Brueger disagrees with Kurzweil that humans can ever come close to perfection with technology.
Well, I don't think that the technology is the problem. What I have concerns about is the philosophy that stands behind it, the idea that somehow we're going to be able to overcome human limitation or we're going to overcome death.
What troubles Brueger the most is the notion that technology will one day replace God.
If we start to think about technology as a kind of savior, is it going to overcome our misguided ambitions? Is it going to overcome those kinds of prejudices that cause us to hate our neighbors? To many of us who follow a religion, we'd say that God can help us to overcome those things.
Kurzweil argues that it's human nature for mankind to utilize technology to overcome human limitations.
We are the species that does change ourselves. We didn't stay on the ground. We didn't stay on the planet. We didn't stay with the limits of our biology. If you want to speak in religious terms, you can say that's what God intended us to do.
Kurzweil bases his predictions on what he calls the exponential growth of artificial intelligence in the fields of genetics, nanotechnology, and robotics.
Information technology is growing exponentially, not linearly. Our intuition says it grows like this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 30 steps later you're at 30. The reality is it grows 2, 4, 8, 16, and 30 steps later you're at a billion.
When I was a student at MIT, I went there because it was so advanced at that time it actually had a computer, and it cost tens of millions of dollars. It took up half a building. The computer that I carry around and that we all carry around is a million times less expensive. It's 1,000 times more powerful.
John Donahue is a professor of neuroscience and engineering and director of the Brown University Institute for Brain Science. He says his work has not progressed exponentially. But in only 10 years, he's been able to implant sensors in the brains of paralyzed patients, enabling them to operate a computer, type, run a robotic limb simply by thinking, sending out brain signals.
The value of the technology is, first, for people who are severely paralyzed, the first step is to give them any control at all. They can't do anything without help from someone else. People want and you know, feel some sense of pride in taking care of themselves, so anything we can restore is a great step.
next best.
Neuroscience has yielded other life-altering advances. For instance, there are now over 75,000 Parkinson's patients worldwide who've had tiny electrodes implanted in their brains. Doctors say the operation significantly reduces tremors and allows patients to rely less on medications.
By the way, nobody is picketing, protesting, oh, people putting computers in their brains, that that's somehow unnatural or defies the way things should be.
Bioethicist Brueger worries that science will soon cross the line to where brain implants will not simply heal patients, but enhance their ability to think and compete.
If we move in this direction of radical human enhancement, are we going to develop those who are and those who aren't, the enhanced and the unenhanced? I mean, Lord, we can't even find the money to get everyone who needs braces.
When the technologies are only affordable by the rich, they actually don't work very well. Consider mobile phones. 15 years ago, someone took out a mobile phone in a movie. That was a signal, okay, this person's very powerful and wealthy. And they didn't work very well. Now, 5 billion people out of 6 billion have mobile phones, and they actually work pretty well.
A lot of people worry about one day there'll be a knock on the door and there'll be a robot. And say, where did that come from? And I would tell you, the future is going to be much stranger.
Absolutely. Colin Angle is the co-founder and CEO of iRobot, better known as the creator of the Roomba, the floor cleaning robot, or the PackBot robot used to disarm roadside bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan. And soon to be released, robots that can keep track of grandma and remind her when it's time to take her meds.
We call it a physical avatar. And so that these robots would allow a doctor to visit a patient in their own home without ever having to leave his doctor office. These robots are meant to be surrogates for people, so the personality of the doctor will be the personality of the robot.
I think iRobots are wonderful. If they can do the vacuuming for me so I can read a good book, I'm happy with that. But iRobots are not my wife, and they're not my children. They're not even an animal.
Angle doesn't believe robots will ever replace humans, but he says, notwithstanding the science fiction stories of robots run amok, society needs them.
Throughout history, there's many different situations where technology exists and can be used for good or evil. And I think that as robots become more capable, we need to be careful about using robots to help society.
The classic scary story is the Matrix, of course, where you plug in and you live in this other reality.
The reality where computers take over the world.
We marveled at our own magnificence as we gave birth to AI.
AI? You mean artificial intelligence?
A singular consciousness that spawned an entire race of machines. We don't know who struck first, us or them.
Kurzweil himself worries about technology falling into the wrong hands.
The same technologies that are being used to reprogram biology away from heart disease and cancer, presumably good things, could be deployed by a bioterrorist to reprogram a biological virus to be more destructive. And that's actually a specter that exists right now.
He says he's working with the military to develop a system to detect rogue viruses, something like the virus protection found in today's computer software. But he sees the good society can gain from artificial intelligence far outweighing the bad.
That was the family religion. You can find, it's personalized. You, Ray, can find the ideas that will change the world.
Kurzweil has patented over 24 inventions, including the first music synthesizer, which he sold to Stevie Wonder. President Clinton awarded him the National Medal of Technology, and few have more faith in technology than Ray Kurzweil.
Computers are already better than humans at logical thinking. It is our emotional intelligence, the ability to be funny, to get the joke. That is the cutting edge of human intelligence. That's the most sophisticated, complicated thing we do. And that's exactly the heart of my prediction, that these computers will match us in emotional intelligence, which includes our whole moral system.
I don't think that'll ever be reached, because now we're dealing in the realm of the spirit. If the entire realm of the spirit that's been spoken about in the history of poetry and literature and philosophy and theology is reducible to electrical synapse, then we can reproduce it eventually in a machine, because electricity is at the basis of the machine. I deny that premise. I think that there's more to human beings than what's reducible to measurable stimuli. And in that regard, I don't think that machines are ever going to be able to be human.
Undaunted by his critics and skeptics, Kurzweil is so convinced that artificial intelligence will one day enable man to live forever, he's doing everything he can to be around when it happens.
Well, here's to living forever. That's not just a salutation in our family.
I want to live indefinitely, and actually I think we all do. People say, oh, I don't want to live forever. 100 would be great. When they get to 100, they don't want to die tomorrow.
Kurzweil is so determined to live indefinitely, he takes as many as 200 supplements each day. Says this regimen made it possible to reverse both his diabetes and his age. His most recent full-blown checkup results show he has the body and mind of a 40-year-old. Kurzweil is 62 and striving for immortality. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Boston.
Now a special update about organ donation. It used to be that most organ transplants came from deceased donors. But in the case of kidney transplants, medical advances have opened the door for many more transplants from living donors. Experts say it is an ethical good to become an organ donor. But how far should society go in promoting organ donation? Kim Lawton has our story.
It's early morning at Washington Hospital Center and time for a quick prayer before Flavia Walton heads into surgery.
Please help my mother get through this safely. Please help the surgeons and guide their hands, Lord.
For 8 years, Flavia's husband, Bill, has had severe kidney disease, and Flavia is donating a kidney. But her kidney isn't going to Bill. They weren't compatible enough, at least when it came to kidneys, so Bill had to be put on the transplant list.
You are placed on the list. And then the wait begins. And it goes on and on and on. And your only hope is you can check the list on the internet and see if the numbers are getting any smaller, but they never do.
Then Bill and Flavia heard about a program known as a paired kidney exchange, where Flavia could donate her kidney to somebody else, and in exchange, Bill would get a kidney from another donor who was a perfect match.
Bottom line here is you got to give one to get one.
The Waltons were part of the world's largest kidney swap to date, sponsored by Washington Hospital Center and Georgetown University Hospital. It involved a complex chain of 28 surgeries at four different hospitals. Most of the donors gave a kidney in order to benefit a friend or family member. But a couple of donors did it out of a sense of altruism, with no particular recipient in mind. In the end, 14 patients who'd been particularly hard to match received kidney transplants. The donors and recipients were introduced to each other at an emotional news conference.
I love this guy. I don't even know him, but I love him.
You can't imagine how fortunate I feel that somebody from somewhere in the universe came and gave me a kidney.
To see someone that you love most in the world deteriorate is a sense of helplessness and powerlessness that you just cannot comprehend unless you've been there. But to be able to do something is so empowering, but it is such a blessing.
More than 100,000 Americans are currently on the waiting list for an organ transplant, the vast majority of them waiting for a kidney. Over the last decade, an estimated 60,000 people died while still waiting for a transplant. Given those numbers, many experts say there's a moral obligation to encourage more people to become organ donors.
Just a little nudge would do enormous amounts of good in terms of saving lives and making sick people's lives better.
The incentive for Flavia Walton to become an organ donor was clearly to benefit her husband of 42 years.
If God could give his son for me or for us, I could certainly give a kidney to keep someone else alive. And I certainly want to keep him around as long as possible. I don't know if he wants to keep me around that much longer. But
no, I got no complaints.
Okay. But no, it was not a hard decision at all.
Living donors are screened psychologically to ensure they are not being unduly pressured into the surgery. It is major surgery, but because of medical advances, the risks to the donors are quite low. Because of these factors, Professor Veach at Georgetown University's Kennedy Institute of Ethics says there are few ethical problems with kidney swaps, such as the one the Waltons were part of.
If we can get a living donor, we get a better kidney, a more viable kidney, and it shows up in the survival rate statistics.
His main ethical concern with the swaps is making sure that kidney patients without a loved one willing to donate are not pushed lower on the waiting list, particularly those with hard-to-match blood types.
We at least want to be fair with the people on the wait list who don't have a family member available. Being fair might mean waiting a trivial extra amount of time, but we certainly don't want to make those people wait years extra just because of the swap arrangements.
While the swap program has been successful, some other strategies to encourage organ donation have run into roadblocks because of the National Organ Transplant Act, which forbids any monetary compensation for organ donation. 25 years ago, Veach testified in support of that law, but he's now urging that it be revisited. He's calling for experimentation with some token financial incentives. For example, he would support a modest discount on driver's license renewals for people who sign up to be organ donors. Or, he says, there could be a question on income tax returns asking people to be donors and even offering a tax deduction for those who say yes.
It sort of taints the altruism of organ donation. On the other hand, real human lives are at stake here, and I would be willing to compromise the altruism at the margins if we could really save some lives.
Veach also says the religious community should do more to promote organ donation.
It's considered an altruistic charitable act, and all the major religions look favorably upon that behavior.
Veach tries to counter one theological concern he hears among some conservative Christians, especially in the Black Church, who believe individuals will be bodily resurrected in the end times, and therefore they worry about the implications of organ donation.
The doctrine is, when you're resurrected, you'll be resurrected to look like you, but with all the bad stuff fixed. So if you had cancer, the cancer won't be there. And if organs have been procured or consumed by fire, you'll get a new version of the body.
Flavia Walton, who's a member of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, says she tries to address that theological issue in her community as well.
I think that there is some notion or some belief among many that feel that when we meet our Maker, we have to meet our Maker all in one piece. For me, it means I just want to meet the Maker. I don't think the Maker cares whether I'm all in one piece or not. I don't think that's the issue.
The Waltons say organ donation is of particular concern to African Americans because more than 60% of patients who need transplants are non-white. At the same time, African Americans have a disproportionately low rate of organ donation. The Waltons hope their story can help change that.
Exposure is key. And the more we can expose to that population, that it works, and we're examples of that, the more emphasis we can get out there that spread the word, and let's proceed.
After 2 years on dialysis, Bill says he can't believe how great he feels now. He says the gift of someone else's kidney has meant everything to him.
Life, basically. You can't get any more basic than that. Life with a little ginger thrown in, because it's a life that is much more comfortable than what I had.
Flavia says donating a kidney turned out to be a spiritual experience for her, definitely worth the short time she spent recovering from surgery.
Just feeling good that I've been able to do something, and that hopefully I'll be able to make a difference not only in the life of the recipient of my kidney, but hopefully it'll spread, and hopefully I'll be able to make a difference in helping other people make a decision to make a difference in the lives of others.
And as politicians and ethicists wrestle over how to encourage more organ donations, the Waltons hope stories like theirs will be the best incentive of all. I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
That's our program for now. I'm Tim O'Brien. There's much more on our website, including more from futurist Ray Kurzweil. And we have extra material on organ donation, including more from the emotional event where organ donors and recipients meet one another for the first time. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. And you can follow us on our Facebook page. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from a service held in Turkey last Sunday at a Greek Orthodox monastery once closed by the Turkish government. Thousands of people attended the service, the first held at this site in almost 90 years.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.